This Is Money's podcast is brought to you in partnership with the Financial Services Compensation Scheme. Check your financial products at FSCS Protected at fscs.org.uk/thisismoney.
Welcome to This Is Money. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And if you haven't got your tax return in yet, get your skates on. The clock is ticking, but... well, you can't be too smug if you're a full-time employee, because you too may need to submit one. Also today, the anger over the overdraft overhaul continues as the watchdog admits a third of us will be worse off. Is it time for the challengers to step up? Plus, we look at the 10 cars that hold their value best and ask what happened next for Olympic medal-winning boxer Anthony Ogogo. And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk. or download the app. But first, the self-assessment tax return deadline is just around the corner. For the less organised of us, it is hell. I include myself in that. I have just been through it. But are you so sure that you aren't among the 11 million who need to submit by January the 31st? Now, we've employed the help of some of the country's top tax experts to run through 10 reasons why you, even as a full-time employee on PAYE, may need to submit a tax return and avoid, of course, penalties. We should point out, though, that this is not an exhaustive list. And if you are not sure, do get some professional advice. Do hurry up with that, though. But go for it, Simon. Hit us with this. Why on earth would you need to submit a tax return if you are comfortably full-time, self-employed, PAYE, like your good selves?
Yes. Well, as you said, if you do have any questions about this, then you can consult an expert or you can call HMRC. But do hurry up.
Good luck with that.
Tax return deadline is the 31st of January, and you could spend that long waiting on the phone.
You could do pretty much. been there.
I mean, apparently they have got better. I haven't had the joyful experience of phoning HMRC in recent years, but the last time I did, it was a fairly painful experience.
I made a whole set of brownies during the time I was on the phone.
Yeah?
I made them, I cooked them, and they're all ready to eat. And then do you know what at the end of they said? Oh, you're not supposed to call us today. It's tomorrow. Oh, but at least I had some brownies.
Do you have an appointment to call,
no,
presumably?
It's because you have a month with which to call to make sure. For whatever reason, I think they charged me wrongly for something. But you have to give it a month. And I was one day out. There you go.
Tax does not have to be taxed,
but
as they say.
But it is.
Say. No. So, you're paid PAYE. You have a job. Your employer takes all the tax that you are meant to pay and they hand it over to the tax man before you even get your hands on the money. So you don't need to worry about a tax return. And you're one of those many, many people who read all this stuff at this time of year, hear all the warnings and think, I'm all right, Jack, doesn't concern me. Well, it may be that you do have to fill in a tax return. And there are some reasons, as you said before. First reason, you run a side hustle. This is a modern way of saying you earn some money somewhere else.
Right.
Now, this is an increasingly popular thing to do. People might earn a bit of money from, I don't know, they might make things and sell them on the internet on the side. Yep. Perhaps they're a bit crafty, as in they craft things, not
yes.
as in
they're hustles and craftiness.
Yes.
This all sounds really dodgy. It's
yeah.
not.
I mean, maybe they run a small business at the weekend. Maybe there's lots of things that you can do. Now, there are some allowances. There's a trading allowance up to £1,000. Mm. Also, there is the, for example, if you're renting out a room, there's the rent a room allowance, which covers you up to a certain point. And if you stay under those levels, you don't need to declare it. But if you're over those levels, then you should declare it and you should be filling in a tax return. Now, the key thing, I think, for a lot of these people, as we go through this list, is that if you've had to do a tax return before for one of these reasons, then you will know you need to do a tax return. And in fact, if you've had to do a tax return before, or HMRC has told you you need to do a tax return before, you have to keep doing one until they tell you you can stop. Mm-hmm. And they do sometimes tell you you can stop. They did tell me once. And then they told me how to do it again. And they haven't told me I can stop yet. If it's the first time round that you're doing one of these things, you might not realise. So, you earn more than £100,000 a year. Well done, you. Mm-hmm. More than £100,000 a year, the government decides to start taking your personal allowance off you. The bad news is that that means you pay a 60% tax rate on every extra pound you earn. The good news is that if we'd have had a Labour government, it would have been 67%. So, you know, because they were going to raise the
every
taxes
cloud,
below this.
Simon, every yes. cloud.
The increasing bad news is that the way that this is calculated, and I've never quite managed to get my head around whether people are being somewhat diddled on this, but it certainly seems like it, is that all of your income is added to get you above that 100,000.
Yep.
But it even includes some things where you have a tax-free allowance. So, for example, if you earn £99,000 a year, but you are in the fortunate position where you get £2,000 in savings interest during that year, you must add that £2,000 in savings interest onto your £99,000, which will take you up to £101,000. You will therefore lose 50p of your personal allowance for every £1 you go over that £100,000. But £500 of that savings has the tax-free savings allowance attached to it. You're a high-rate taxpayer, so you don't get the full £1,000. So £500 of the money that's being added on to take away your personal allowance is actually tax-free money. Yeah. The same is true of dividends. There's a £2,000 a year dividend allowance. You have to add that on as well. Pensions also. You add your pension contributions in, and then they bump up the level at which you pay higher rate tax. It's not as many people think that you can just subtract that pension contribution from your income to bring you back down below the 100,000. But anyway, if you're over £100,000 a year, you need to fill in the tax return. You want to claim higher rate tax relief on your pension. When you pay money into a pension, you automatically get basic rate tax relief in most cases, so it gets bumped up by 25% to replace the 20% tax that you've paid. That's how maths works, folks. If you take 20% off something, you need to add 25% to it to get back. But if you want your higher rate tax relief, then you need to claim it, ideally through a tax return or by writing to HMRC. You make money outside the UK, so this is a tricky area, but if you're making money outside the UK, you're probably going to need to submit a tax return, even if there is a double taxation agreement that means you shouldn't be paying tax in two countries. It's probably best to declare it. You receive high income child benefit. You start getting child benefit taken off you if you or your partner earn more than £50,000 a year. Once you get to £60,000 a year, it's all gone and there's no point taking the child benefit. Some people do take the child benefit and then pay it back. If you are taking the child benefit, you're going to need to do a tax return in order to pay it back. Crucially here, though, if you have a child and your partner earns more than the £60,000 a year and you know that you're not going to get child benefit, do not just go, I'm not going to get child benefit. You must register and then you must tick a box to say that you don't want to take the money, because this is what gives you state pension credits when you're not working and looking after a child. See podcast pass. Yeah. This is Money Investigations. This is Money Campaign for the absolute dog's breakfast that the government has made of this one. Lots of people have lost out on pension years. The government make it very difficult to get those pension years back. So do register. And anybody you know who has a child, tell them as well. Okay? They give you this information in your bounty pack, which is great because that's basically a bag full of marketing material handed to people who've just had babies.
Yeah, when you're in a great frame of mind, I imagine. Yeah,
and when my wife got hers, I told her to throw it straight in the bin because she wasn't signing up to any of that stuff because we'd get endlessly spammed and sent letters and things. And she said, I think they get the child benefit form in here. And even I didn't know that bit. Wow. So, yeah, pay attention. You let out space in your home or your entire home. Alluded to this earlier. Rent a room scheme lets you earn up to £7,500 a year tax-free from letting out furnished accommodation in your own home. This could be a single room, a whole floor. Whether it can be your entire property or not is a bit debatable. If you go over the £7,500, then you need to obviously fill a tax return. If you're under it, you don't necessarily need to. You've made some capital losses. You have sold some shares and you made a loss on them. Well, the good news is that you can claim that back against capital gains tax in the future. Bad news is you lost money on your investments.
Exactly.
But so declare it so that HMRC know, and then if you make a gain in future years, you can set it against that. Obviously, you do have a capital gains tax allowance every year, which is fairly generous, but it can be possible to go over that. For example, you sell a second home or buy-to-let property you've owned for some time, you're likely to go well over it. Or people later on in life who've built up big investments outside of an ISA, because until recently you were quite limited on the money you could put into an ISA, they could find themselves paying capital gains tax. Eight, you've sold a hefty chargeable asset like a house. That's the thing I just said. So you've made more than the capital gains tax allowance. You've got to fill in the tax return. 9, you've ploughed cash into venture capital schemes. These are very, very tax efficient. They give you income tax relief in order to reward you for the high risk level of investment and the fact that you're investing into smaller companies, fledgling companies, the future of growth in this country. If you've put money into a VCT, you're probably a fairly sophisticated investor and you've probably twigged that you need to fill in a tax return. If you haven't done that, you should probably look a little bit more into what you're investing your money in, and you should fill in a tax return. Mm-hmm. And number 10, HMRC says you need to file one. Sometimes HMRC right. just sends you a letter and says you need to file a tax return this year. This is where lots of people get caught out because they get the letter and then they just forget about it. And the letter could arrive long before the deadline. I mean, obviously, you can do your tax return the moment the new tax year starts. Obviously, most people leave it until the last minute. There's a definite contrast in my house, where my wife, who is self-employed, runs her own business, pretty much does her tax return and gets her accountant to do it for her the moment April the 6th hits. Whereas I'm still sitting there at the end of January, not having done mine, although I have actually done it now.
Congratulations.
Yes, I did it with 10 days to spare. So those are the reasons why you need to do a tax return, even if you don't think you need to do one. And once you do start doing a tax return and delving into it, you will start experiencing the joy of the British tax system, as I said, and encountering all kinds of things that you think, that doesn't seem fair or right, and I can't quite work out whether I'm being done over here, which you would like to think that the official tax system isn't doing you over. And I should say now that I probably believe it isn't. But there is always that doubt in your mind.
I thought once upon a time when George Osborne was Chancellor, I'm sure he had a little soundbite saying we're going to see the death of the tax return. And then it was all going to get a bit simpler. But, you know, as someone that has never filled in a tax return, I don't know what it's like. All I can, you know, is anecdotal evidence from people that say how difficult it is, how long-winded it is. And it's that classic, people just leave it to the last minute. And actually, there was a Freedom of Information request that shows between 2012 and 2018, 4 million people filed their tax returns late.
Really? 4 million. 4 million?
4 million, yeah. And one third of those actually managed to dodge the fine. So you get a £100 fine, it goes up.
Plus interest.
Plus interest, and then it starts to go up. Yeah. But there are reasonable excuses, which you can find on the government website, that could potentially give you an extension. So don't, you know, ideally you don't leave it to that last minute. Yeah. We always see those stories about people that file their tax returns on Christmas Day, for example. But leaving it to the last minute, yeah. I know that it's a difficult thing, and I can imagine if I was having to fill one in, I would definitely fall in the category of doing it the day before, because you give me a deadline of a year, it's going to take me ages.
I would have said in the past, so I've done it myself, that it wasn't actually that difficult. But then I've got a bit of, without going too much into my taxes and my financial affairs, I've got a business account, I've got my normal account, and all these things need to be worked out. And it's only this year when I've realised the number of questions, because I'm an accountant, that my accountant asks me, it makes it sound like I'm earning loads of money. I'm not at all, but the accountant is asking me tons of questions. And I'm thinking, how many people who don't have an accountant would know the answer to this? So I'm wondering, you're saying 4 million filed late, a third of those avoided a fine, yeah.
That's over a six-year period, by the way. It's not 4 million people a year.
But I'm wondering how many people...
It's the same 4 million people.
Guys, come on, it's the 31st of January. I'm wondering how many people get it wrong, and not just underpay, but overpay as well. How many people are getting it wrong?
How many people are getting it wrong? Probably quite a few. And one of the reasons why is one of the reasons why I was going to say I think a lot of people end up filing late is two things. They leave it not necessarily until the final day or the final hour, or I bet there's loads of people who do that one. They sit down to do it and then they realise that they don't have all the information. So you do have to fill in, although it's very simple and the online system is very simple, you do have to get quite a lot of information. You need your P60 from work. So that's how much you earned last year and all the details of that. You need your P11D, which yep. tells you anything about any taxable benefits you might get. So if you've got health insurance through work, you need to know how much savings interest you got from all the different savings accounts you had. You need to know how much dividend income you had from any shares, funds, trusts that you hold outside of an ISA. You need to find out all of these things. And people sit down
loans,
and go, oh, I don't, where am I going to, I don't have this information. What did I do with my P60? Yeah. What did I do with my P11D? So, for example, we can look up our P60 on our internal system, but you can't find your P11D. So you have to look for the email, yeah. and that will catch people out. The other thing that catches people out is you can't just sit down and do your tax return. You need to log into the system. And if you haven't registered for the system, you need to register for the system. And it takes time to register for the system. Not as in it takes 10 minutes of sitting there having to rewrite a password 7 times so you can jump through the different hoops for your password. It's you need to get sent something. So if you leave it too late, you can't get the thing in time. Or you sit down and then you remember that you can't remember your login details. Tip. Write them down.
Yeah.
Just write them down.
Absolutely.
I don't care what any cybersecurity expert says about this. Hide where you've written them down. Write them down in two different places. But if you do that, you won't find the other place. But just write
them
down.
That's true.
Because otherwise, you'll sit down a year on from when you last sat down to do it, having already thought, I should have done this 3 weeks ago, and you'll go, oh, how do I get into this system?
Exactly. If this is you and you're still going, good luck.
Or if you're one of those people who smugly filed your tax return on April the 7th last year, drop us an email and tell us about how good you feel and what you do with the time that you've therefore freed up for yourself.
Your Christmas peace. Day, how was that? Yeah. Right, we're going to move on, going to get angry because we're going to talk a little bit more about the overdraft debacle because that is continuing apace at the moment, unsurprisingly. And the watchdogs come out and said a third could be worse off after the changes. We spoke about it last week. Lee, you got quite het up about... Well, Simon did too. He's even written an article about it. Lloyds and Halifax now, the latest. They've revealed some of their customers could pay a 49.9% rate. Now, the FCA, they wanted to end unauthorised overdraft rip-offs, to stop banks hitting people with these simple daily charges that were actually hugely expensive. But they've unleashed a monster where most banks now charge almost 40%. Lee, I won't get you to go back over it, but just ever so briefly, what am I talking about here and why are we in this situation?
The overdraft monster.
And then
monster.
Simon can get angry.
That's nicely illustrated, that the overdraft monster. Imagine like the Loch Ness monster coming out of a lake, you know, with high fees. Yeah, I like it.
Exactly.
So we have seen banks responding to an FCA paper last year saying that people need to have one overdraft rate. There can't be different fees for dipping into the red at different levels. There can't be varying rates. It needs to be one blanket rate to make it easier for people to see how much they're getting charged on a daily, weekly, monthly basis for dipping into the red. What's happened is if you dip into the red just a little bit, you're probably going to be a bit worse off than before. Mm. If you're someone that is really far into the red, you're probably going to be better off than you would have been before. That's really sort of like, you know, basic. You need to crunch the maths on this to see. If you are someone that regularly dips into the overdrafts, which millions of people do every month, you could be worse off. You might not be worse off. What has been galling about this, though, is that banks have come out, and instead of the FCA perhaps doing the right thing, I would argue, in putting a cap in place of how much.
But we don't like caps, do we? We complain about caps a lot.
Well, you've got the energy price cap.
That was popular, wasn't it?
But an overdraft, rate of up to 50%. So the reason why we're talking about this again this week is because Lloyds, which is basically the biggest current account provider in Britain, has come out and said 39.9% rate for most, but some people could be facing 49.9%, and it's the people who are high risk. They're seen as high risk. So it's basically the people that are
the
most likely.
Right?
Yeah, which I'm not going to sit here and start defending banks, but one thing I will say is that it's one of those things where you can't just continuously be in debt, you know, in an overdraft. You should be trying to get your way out of it. And that's what this fundamentally is trying to do. But it's just gone about it the wrong way with a rate of 49.9% when you compare it to how cheap personal loans are, when you consider how cheap mortgages are, when you consider how low savings rates are. I just think it's an incredibly high rate to expect people to borrow on. And what should have actually been done is more work to get people out of the red, yeah, instead of just living in that way and paying those charges. It's worth billions of pounds to banks.
I was going to say, the banks surely love the fact we're in overdrafts all the time because we pay them a heck of a lot of money. I got into a bit of a Twitter debate with someone about this who completely blamed the FCA for this. And I went, no. Blame where it's due. The banks are the ones that raise the rates. Is it sort of... Am I being a bit unfair to the banks and a bit too fair to the FCA? I don't think they intended to do this. And, you know, Lee, you talk about bringing in a cap. We saw what happened with, or the arguments ahead of bringing in the energy cap, where people said, oh, everybody will bunch together, they'll raise their prices.
But they've done it.
So had they brought in a cap, the same thing, exactly.
Yeah,
they've
but
done
then
it anyway.
It would have been 25%, not 40%.
But then people would have argued the same thing. Did anybody see these sort of rates coming? Clearly, okay, the FCA so didn't, unless they are, you know...
The first one out of the traps earlier this year was Nationwide Building Society.
Yeah.
And I must admit, we were pretty surprised by that one. Solid 39.9%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the rate before was, what, I think 18.9% or something like that. I think that, and in my comment piece on this, I wrote that the FCA, I believe the FCA's plan has backfired. Now, it claims that it hasn't, but I believe it has, and I'll explain why in a minute. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, it's the banks that should be embarrassed about this.
Yeah.
I mean, which bright sparks in the banks sat down and thought, I know, 39.9%. That's a fair rate. No one will complain about that. That'd be all right. Yeah, we'll just do 39.9%.
Mm.
And someone in the next bank along, someone went, what rate should we do? Should we do 39.9%? That seems fair enough. Yeah, and those other guys did it as well, didn't they? I don't think that'll cause any fuss whatsoever. So basically, you've got most of them have gone for 39.9%. You do have the wonderful scenario where one of them has not gone for 39.9%. RBS and NatWest have gone for 39.49%, whereas Barclays has gone for a positively cuddly 35%.
Goodness.
The banks, I think, have massively shot themselves in the foot here. They have not produced any evidence that I have seen that justifies the why the rates are so high. There's not been any explanation as to where... The rate of interest usually that you charge someone reflects the element of risk that you are taking in lending them money. Now, any explanation along those lines has been very absent from this, from any of the banks. A lot of them have argued that it is cheaper than before. Now, the FCA has also come out this week and said 7 out of 10 people will be in the same position or better off than they were previously. However, I believe that this is fundamentally flawed and based on a fundamentally flawed piece of logic. Because what has happened here is two things have been conflated. Overdraft charges, the charges for dipping into the red, using your overdraft, and unauthorised overdraft charges. Now, that's for going into the red further than your overdraft. Now, unauthorised overdraft charges, as we all know, go back to the bank charges debate of many, many years ago. And this was a racket from the banks. The banks were lending people money that they shouldn't have been able to get because they'd already gone through their agreed overdraft. And instead of stopping at the end of their agreed overdraft, the bank would let them have some more money, but it would whack them with massive charges for it. So, you know, it used to be, what, £20, £25 each time, then an extra charge on the interest and so on. They were creaming in money. We had a huge campaign to stop this, to help people reclaim it. It then went to court against the banks. The consumers won. Then it went to appeal, backwards and forwards. Unfortunately, the banks eventually won on a very high level of appeal, which meant they could continue to charge these bank charges. They did slightly rein them in after that, because they'd realised that they'd probably overstepped the mark, but they were still doing it. But they also then introduced these simple daily fee overdrafts, which were easy to understand. They were easy to understand, but they were also hugely expensive, because if you dip into the red by £100 for perhaps 5 days of the month before payday, which lots of people do, then on an interest rate of 18.9%, you pay a pittance. You pay 26p, hardly anything. If you are paying £1 a day, you could be paying £5. You compare that £5 to the amount of money that you borrowed and the period of time that you borrowed it over, you're paying near payday loan levels of cost. So it is fair to compare these new overdraft charges to what were the standard overdraft charges before. But it's not fair to also compare them to the unauthorised overdraft charges and use this 7 out of 10 customers thing, because most people don't use an unauthorised overdraft. So actually, if you take your normal average bank customer who never, ever, ever went into an unauthorised overdraft and didn't end up getting whacked with these charges, you would come up with a very, very different statistic to the one that's been put out. And also, if you take that customer and then compare them to where they stood before these daily charges were brought in, okay, because these daily charges system was a very was quite a short-lived thing. It's only we're only talking maybe five years, 6 years, I don't know, time passes quickly. If you go from where we are now to where we were before then, which should have been cracked down on sooner, to be perfectly honest, then people are worse off. So the average person is worse off. And also they've had things removed like interest-free buffers, £250 interest-free overdraft buffer. That's been removed with this desire to completely standardise it. So I'm sorry, but the FCA 7 out of 10 will be the same or better off. I don't buy those statistics. I think that they are flawed in the way they've been compiled. But even if you accept they're not flawed, that still means that a third of people are going to be worse off. And I think what's hilarious about this whole thing, beyond the fact that, as I quipped the other day, you know, are the same people who thought 39.9% would be a good rate for an overdraft the same people who decided to, you know, widen the gaps in the Toblerone and thought, yeah, nobody will mind that. Yeah, we'll definitely get away with that one. Is the fact that, ironically, I reckon what's going to end up happening is there's going to end up being a cap. There's been such a massive fuss about this.
I'm going to ask what next.
So, yeah, exactly. I think there's going to end up being a cap. I think the FCA is going to end up doing something. Maybe not now. It's probably going to let it bed in, but probably somewhere down the line. So I think that this has backfired for the banks. I think it's backfired for the FCA. The FCA was absolutely 100% well-meaning in what it did. This was unintended consequences. I get why they didn't want to do a cap. We don't like caps because people bunch around it. But do you know what? The banks have just acted like a cartel anyway.
Yeah.
And they've all gone for the same rate. And if the FCA had just introduced a cap of 25%, we'd have never had this row. None of this stuff would have happened. I mean, they're desperately fighting this rearguard action. They keep putting out this stuff trying to get their point across. But I'm sorry, only my opinion, but I think this has massively backfired.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. I think it has. But I kind of think once the FCA sort of pull the finger out, if they do something about this, excuse the expression, but the poor sods that have had 2-3 years of paying that, surely the horse has bolted.
Yes. And the only other thing I would say is what keeps getting put forward is, well, an overdraft is not a good way of borrowing. OK, so maybe people should be thinking about borrowing in different ways. If you are permanently in your overdraft, then you should definitely be thinking about borrowing in other ways. You should be trying to think about personal loan in order to pay that off. Maybe you could even opt for a credit card, a balance transfer or something like that. But there are inherent risks with credit cards that you don't pay it off and then you end up paying a high rate of interest, although that rate of interest is now half your overdraft thanks to these measures. And personal loans, they may be very cheap, but not everybody can get those personal loans. 51% of successful applicants. There's lots of people who end up getting quoted much higher rates. Also, you can't take a personal loan to borrow some money for 5 days before you get paid. And arguably, you are much better off dipping into your overdraft 5 days before you get paid, because you will then get paid and it will take you back up out of the overdraft automatically and you can probably handle that, than you are putting the money on a credit card. Because if you put it on a credit card, you've then got to remember to pay it off. Yeah. And the reason why the credit card industry exists is because people don't pay the money off. And that's how credit card companies make money. So I think that that argument is totally flawed when you look at consumer behaviour.
Yeah, completely agree with you. Are we three agrees? Yeah. All right. Nod from Lee there. But Lee, I'm going to ask you, in this Twitter exchange that I had, the call for the challenger banks to step in, step up, save the day, because we have been getting some research suggesting that Monzo and Starling, they are the big winners of the current account switchers. It comes as there's speculation over the future too of RBS's £100 million digital challenger bank, Bo, which I hope I've pronounced correctly, which was meant to be a big part of the bank's strategy to attract younger customers. So is it under threat? Firstly, Lee, before we get into this, B-O with an accent.
It's a boe.
Bo. Like Spanish, so the accent is on the O. But...
Well, that's it. I've got no idea. I'm not sure if you asked anyone at NatWest, they'd probably have an idea. They've just put an accent above the O, I think, to kind of do something a bit different. When we asked them about it a couple of months ago, they said it didn't mean anything in English. So it's just to try and make a brand.
Well, bone does mean something in English, but only to those who remember Craig David.
Exactly, yeah. Nice. Which would be a great advert fit, you know, if the bank survives. So what's happened is they've kind of made this digital bank. The thing is with a lot of big banks is that they have legacy IT systems. They're not very nimble. Yep. You know, they have a lot of historic problems, things that make it difficult. It's like trying to turn around a huge ship, whereas a lot of these... upstart digital banks just are starting from the ground up in a modern era, and it's just a bit easier. They're way more nimble to sort of react to the market and create, I guess, where we've all been pushed on to having app-based banking or to bank online, they've been able to develop little things that people quite like. And that's basically now started to be copied by quite a lot of the big banks. So it's launched Bo, and it's launched a business bank called Metal. And it's a kind of, I think, to try and get it away from the whole RBS NatWest of old, thinking about, you know, the financial crisis, having to be bailed out, all that kind of thing. Anyway, the boss of that, the digital boss of that, is rumoured to be going next month, 2 months after it launched. It hasn't confirmed those reports, but... You know, we don't know what the inner workings are of that, what's going on behind the scenes.
But they're saying, it's still going. It's still a big part of our future.
They're saying it's a big part of its future. And it's the idea is that it's battling Monzo and Starling, who have been monumentously popular in the last couple of years.
Why? Because, I mean, they're talking about having this bank bow. I mean, is it all in a name, all in a... You know, because it's still essentially... part of the RBS.
It is, but interestingly, I haven't seen any adverts for Boat, but I have seen adverts for Metal, the business bank, and we wrote something about it a little while ago because I'd spotted these adverts on the train. And it was in very, very, very small writing that it was part of the RBS group. Now you think back business banking with RBS and the whole controversy they had.
Yeah, of course.
It's trying to, my thinking is that it's trying to kind of make a brand that people might not necessarily realise is RBS, but will with a little bit
like
of research.
First Direct and HSBC,
a little bit,
right?
Exactly,
Everybody hates HSBC, but loves First Direct.
Well, I think that's a bit harsh. It's like everyone hates HSBC, but no, I know exactly what you mean. Like First Direct is like was like the cooler, you know, younger kid on the block. But I mean, that's turned 4 decades old this decade. So I mean, it's been around for quite a while now. Yeah. So I think it's just
apologies to HSBC if I've offended anyone there. I am a customer. But Monzo particularly. Has done some brilliant PR, but getting the customers to do the PR.
Yeah, exactly. So we were talking about this last week, weren't we?
Yeah.
Where people were talking, posting up their spending habits, how many sandwiches they'd bought at Pret over the year and that kind of thing. They've got 3 million customers now, Georgie. That's not
incredible.
Easy. That's not an easy thing to do in a short space of time.
How have they done it, Lee?
And Starling Bank have 1 million. So what a big argument. I'll take you to the research that's come out this week. So we've got the current account switching figures, which basically show how many people have... chosen to close their bank account and switch all of their direct debits, switch where they get paid, into another bank. Now, Monzo and Starling combined for the summer of last year, which is between July and September, the most recent stats, are now number one. If you combine them, it goes Nationwide, then Monzo, then HSBC, which includes First Direct and M&S, and then Starling. But if you club them both together, they're now number one. So they really are taking the fight to the big banks. But why that is significant... is that people are actually, the data shows that people are actually switching their main current accounts. So, for example, Simon and I have both opened a Starling account. That is not my main bank account. I always have two bank accounts. Before, I had First Direct and I had Metro. Metro had great...
Why do you have two, Lee?
It's in case there's a IT meltdown, something happens these days where you can't access your money in the bank. I always think it's good just to have a couple hundred quid in a second account. I've been arguing that for years.
I have a Revolut card for that.
And exactly. So I think it's always good to have two options open.
It's your bug out bank account.
Exactly, yeah, it's there. But the other reason for it is that these banks always do like a bit of something at the beginning to draw in customers. So Metro, I became a Metro customer because it was good for overseas spending. They reined it in a bit and it wasn't as attractive as it once was, but I stuck with it for a little while. And then Starling, people kept telling me how good Monzo and Starling are, how quickly you can get a card, how good Starling is, for example, for spending overseas. So I closed my Metro bank account down and I got the Starling one. The app is fantastic. I put some money on it. I spent in America on it. Absolutely unbelievable. It comes through straight away. Shows you how much has come out of your account. You've just made a payment in Target straight away. There we go. There it is. Shows you the conversion, all of that kind of stuff. I like that. Mm-hmm. But I also like First Direct, and I've got no problem keeping my main bank account there. And I think that is what a large percentage of customers for Monzo and Starling are doing. They hold very small amounts in their account, and they don't use it as their first, as their main account. But this shows a shift. This shows actual people moving direct debits, moving where they get paid, and making it their main account. And Starling confirmed to us that people who switch with the switching service hold more than double the amount of deposits in their bank account than the rest of their customer base. So those customers are monumentally important for Starling and for Monzo. And it's bearing in mind these figures are sort of from 6 months ago. So the next set of figures, we might see that they've really sort of decimated the big banks. And let's face it, Nationwide is number one. People like it, it's customer service. People like it, it's a building society, even though I would argue technically it's just a bank calling itself a building society. But it does offer things like 5% interest on $2,500. So people are kind of, they need a reason to switch into these things. HSBC, it would be because they were offering a nice juicy bonus. I think it was £175. First Direct, you get £100. I think M&S, you get 180 quid's worth of vouchers if you switch over to them. Those kind of things are working for those banks and getting them in. For Monzo and Starling, it's just almost like word of mouth now. A lot of people are just raving about how good they are, how good the apps are. And people seem to be giving it a go and willing to give it a go.
Simon?
Yeah, I've as Lee said, I've got a Starling account as well. Solidly impressed with it, but mainly use it for overseas spending. But, you know, I might consider moving. I wouldn't consider my personal account going there. I'm very happy with my personal account with First Direct. But maybe I might move our joint account there from Nationwide. But as Lee said, amazing. 10:45, last Saturday morning, sitting in a bar stroke restaurant on the slopes in Austria. I pay a rather large amount of money for, although not as much as I would have paid in France, but a rather large amount of money for a couple of coffees, a hot chocolate and a plate of chips. Yes, we did order a plate of chips at 10 o'clock in the morning. My wife goes to the bathroom before we leave. I opened my Starling app because I wanted to look at something else and discovered that the payment that I have just made to someone has already shown up for how much it is at 10:47. And, I mean, it probably would have showed up immediately at 10:45 if I'd just done it. I was hugely impressed with that.
Yeah.
And things like that.
Simple, isn't it?
Simple, but very clever to do, because that's the kind of thing that people tell other people about. And when people tell other people about things like that, they go, oh, yeah, maybe I'll give that a go. So, yeah, quite clever. Just goes to show how doing things well can be a winner,
isn't it? Simply and well. Just to come full circle on this though, before we sort of leave the banks to one side, Lee, do you think, because I'm just thinking about Monzo's overdraft rates, I think they're offering 19%, 29%, and 39%, is that right? So the 39% is still the the biggie. Are the challengers able to kind of rescue the day in this overdraft debacle, or are they just going to join the rest? Because, Simon, you're talking about things that people are going to be telling their friends about now. But when it comes to the norm, they're just going to be like other big banks with loads of people there and doing the same old thing, aren't they?
You could argue that, Georgie. Yeah, definitely. And it will be interesting to see how it unfolds, because at the end of the day, it's one thing getting in millions of customers, but it's another thing being able to make that profitable. Let's talk business here. Let's talk banks. They're in the business of making profits. Now, you need to be cross-selling those people products. Monzo and Starling don't really have that ability at the moment because they don't really have any other products to cross-sell. Maybe a few bits and pieces. And then we're talking about things like overdrafts. You know, that's, again, where banks make quite a big slice of their profits. Do they really want to go down that route if they're looking like these new trendy new challenger banks that are doing things differently to the big banks? Well, they need to make an underlying profit, don't they, Georgie? So, you know, they can't just be these friendly, cuddly banks that don't charge people for going deeply into their overdraft, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that we've seen it before. Some of these new banks that enter start stripping away the things that were given to customers because they become expensive. I don't know how much it costs Starling to offer 0% you know, on spend in on purchases while you're overseas. But I imagine it's quite a big hit. And it's, you know, overseas fees are one of ways that big banks make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So all those things to consider. But I think a lot of the time with these challenges, it's about building up that customer base. So they're coming out of kind of phase one for me. Or you could argue it's phase two. And phase one where they've launched and they've slowly built up some customers. Then you've got phase two where they've managed to absolutely snowball the amount of customers they've got. And now slowly entering that phase three where it's like, okay, we've now been around for a few years. How are we going to start making this profitable from all these millions of customers we've got? Yeah. We probably can't keep them all happy. Some of them are going to get upset with some of the things that we do, but we've got to start making money. We need to, you know, keep investors happy, et cetera, et cetera. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
Just one final interesting thing from the old Starling app is that in one of my accounts, I made a big payment, £680 the other day. And underneath it, when you look at the transactions, there's a little thing that pops up that says spread the cost of this purchase with a Starling loan. So we were talking about this whole buy now, pay later, spread it kind of thing. But they are not alone in doing this, but some of the banks are being, you could call it proactive in trying to help people spread the cost of payments, or you could maybe call it they're trying to make some money, because obviously if they lend you that money and then charge you a rate of interest, they'll make a profit, whereas if you just spend it from your account, they won't. But it's interesting that, and it's a little button that you can press and then you go off to look at the possibility of getting a loan. I'm not getting a loan for it.
Right.
But
some people do have big expenditures.
But it's quite smart.
Yeah.
It's quite smart.
And you don't want to go into your overdraft, and we're talking about personal loans, and it sort of takes... I'm not necessarily advocating, I'm not saying you should do it, but simple things.
Hmm.
Right, well, let's move on from that. From banks, new banks, to new cars, if you're looking for your next ride, you might want to make sure that it retains its value rather well. So step up This Is Money. Step up Rob Hole, who's done some work on this. He's not here, sorry. But Simon, you can ably jump in his place and tell us, what's he been doing? What do you mean, retaining value well?
So if you buy a brand new car, you will lose money.
Yeah.
It's a certainty. The moment you drive that new car off the forecourt, it's worth less than you paid for it, considerably less than you paid for it.
So accidentally scraping it like about a month after you bought it in a garage somewhere also isn't...
That will also take more money off it. If only one of the reasons why it's worth less money is obviously you pay VAT on a new car for a start. But if you were to go and sell that car to someone else, then you would lose... The VAT thing is a bit of a red herring there, because if you were to say, oh, hang on a minute, I don't want this car anymore the next day, I'll sell it to someone else, you're going to get less money for it, because they could just go buy a brand new car anyway. They'd be the first person on the registration document. There are a handful of cars, very high in demand luxury cars that are limited edition that maybe could be worth more money the next day. But I don't reckon that many people listening to this podcast are going to be buying them. Now, what's interesting about this is that a lot of people buy a brand new car and they'll hold on to it for maybe 3 years, especially seeing as a lot of new cars are sold through PCP deals. A lot of PCP deals last for 3 years. And with a PCP deal, you're effectively funding the depreciation, because you then have the choice to buy it for this future number. Rob has worked with the car experts at CAP HPI. These are the guys who do a lot of the figures for the industry to work out what cars might be worth in 3 years' time. And we have got the top 10 cars that should hold their value the best. I won't go through all of them with all of the percentages. I'll pull out some interesting ones, but there's a real range here. So we've got from a Dacia, which is how you are meant to pronounce Dacia, to a Bentley, and from a Prius to a Porsche, and lots of things in between. A Dacia Sandero Stepway, what is that? It's a hatchback that's been jacked up. Listen to last week's podcast about SUVs or SUV-style cars. Now, Dacias are very cheap cars. You can buy one of these new for £9,340. That's not a lot of money for a brand new car. It will hold its value well as well. The average amount that you will have lost after 3 years and 30,000 miles is £3,628. That means it will have retained 61.3% of its value. Bentley Bentayga.
I'm just blown away by the fact that for how many podcasts have we been saying it wrong? What did you say, Dacia?
Dacia.
See, I'm still saying it wrong.
Bentley Bentayga. Yeah. Now, the Bentley Bentayga is a very different car to the Dacia. The Bentley Bentayga is an extremely expensive four-wheel drive car. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, you could effectively call it an SUV as well. Its average new price is £140,715. So If you do buy a Bentley Bentayga, you should be aware that you could have 14 Darchers instead, but you may decide to go for the Bentley anyway. The average value lost after 3 years. Now, this one, percentage-wise, loses less than the Darcher, but it will lose £54,415, which is quite a lot of money, isn't it? And then we look at the Peugeot 3008. Retains 62% of its value, the Kia Niro, 62.6. Scroll down all the way to the bottom, and the car that holds its value best is the Toyota Prius. Mm. Average price, the Prius Plus, in fact.
Right.
The Prius Plus, average price new, £29,688. Average value retained, 66.2%. The amount of money you will lose is £10,000 over 3 years. That's the best one. What's really interesting here is it just goes to show how much money you lose on a new car. Because even the one that depreciates the least loses 34% of its value over 3 years. So if you buy an average new car, you are going to be looking at losing about 40 to 45% of its value over that three-year period. That's why I don't buy new cars.
I was going to say, I don't know, Lee. Did you buy a new car? I certainly didn't.
Yeah, I bought a new car. Yeah.
Oh, there you go, Lee.
Yeah, no, I bought a new car. Right. But a lot of cars these days are financed, aren't they, on PCP and other such.
Is that what you did?
I didn't know. Oh. I did actually buy the car because looking to keep hold of it for a decade. But, you know, you can completely see why. I didn't buy a car and think, oh, yeah, this is going to hold its value after 3 years. Because as soon as you drive it away, you know you've literally just lost a big chunk of cash on the car. But I kind of try to think about it over a decade period and divide it by the months to think about how much this monthly outlay will cost. Of course, there's going to be things like repair works and services and all of that kind of thing. But I think that the depreciating car thing is just a little bit redundant for a lot of people because they do this kind of three-year cycle of getting a new car, having it for 3 years, then just swapping it for a new one and going in that kind of conveyor belt of PCP or higher purchase.
Also, there is a scenario where I know about Lee's new car. I also know that my mum... So Lee's got a Skoda Karoq. My mum bought a Skoda Kodiaq, which is one slightly bigger than it. And I know that both the Karoq and the Kodiaq, you were getting quite good deals on at the time. And the car makers really, really wanted to sell these cars because car sales are down. And that actually you could buy one brand new for the same price as you could buy one-year-old secondhand. So in that kind of scenario, you know, it's quite often worth buying the new
absolutely.
One.
Yeah, absolutely. Look around. Read This Is Money. Right, we're going to have to end up. But before we do, you will have noticed the Brucey Bonus podcast that's come up in your regular feed. And this week, second episode is a stonker. Simon.
This is our Making the Money Work podcast that we have produced in association with the Financial Services Compensation Scheme. Who are they? They are the people who protect your money, including your savings, up to £85,000 with any UK licensed bank. And we're talking to people with unconventional lives who do things a bit different, lives less ordinary and so on. And this week it is Anthony Ogogo, who is a Olympic medal winning boxer. Remember that sugar rush as we had all those medals come in? Yeah. London 2012. The country was going bananas for the Olympics. Anthony was one of the people who won one of those medals. He won a bronze medal. And he's told us about his career, about what it's like to be an Olympic boxer, whether you make any money. He then turned professional after that, and he had a very successful professional career, but unfortunately it was cut short by an eye injury, fractured eye socket, which meant that he could no longer box. He's now starting a new career as a wrestler. But some really interesting stuff in there. So, for example, he was injured on his way to the Olympics, and he boxed in the Commonwealth Games before that and everything. He was considered an Olympic prospect, but really, you don't get that much support. If you're out and you're injured and it looks like you might not be in the next, it looks like you might not make it, you don't get that much support. Even at the after the Olympics, when he moved up to the top tier of funding, he would have been getting £25,000 a year. That's not a lot of money for someone who's just won an Olympic bronze medal. Professional career, obviously you make more money, but not everybody's making the kind of money you see these big heavyweight boxers make, the millions and millions of pounds paydays. And then also he tells us a lot about how he ended up saving for a rainy day, luckily, because he had some good financial advice. He had some good financial education from his mother when he was growing up. And he had a lot of injuries. He had a lot of rainy days. So anyway, it's a really interesting interview. He's a really nice guy. And I wish him all the best in his new career as a wrestler.
There is sort of a real misconception about how much these athletes get paid. I mean, Lee and I last year spoke to Jordan Reynolds, who's going for Tokyo this year. At the same time, we also spoke to Amir Khan, also rather famously an Olympic medal winner, who's, well, earned a fair bit of money, shall we put it that way. But for every one of those, there are hundreds, thousands of athletes that get paid nothing like that. So it's intriguing to see how they do it.
Yes.
And what comes next.
And we,
so fragile, isn't it? Just I won't go too far down it, but hurt eye and that's it. Boom, your career's done.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Exactly. So anyway, give it a listen. Mm. Come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast, where you'll find the episode. Go to where you normally get your podcast from. It will be appearing in people's podcast feeds. Don't worry, as you're listening to this, you'll know that we are recording our regular podcast every week as well. That comes out on the Friday. This is coming out every Tuesday. There's 5 of them. This is the second one. Next up, we've got an adventurer called Alistair Humphreys, also a very interesting guy. And he's got a big thing about micro-adventures heading out after work. Go sleep on a hillside and see how much it improves your life. So wait for that one, but listen to the one with Anthony. It's really good.
Right, there you go. Sleep on a hillside. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. Thank you very much for that, Simon. If you do have any comments or questions, anything about the podcast or anything you want the team to investigate, look into, Simon,
email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, tweet us at thisismoney, or come to that place I just said about, thisismoney.co.uk/podcast. Find all the episodes, join in the debate in the comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This Is Money's podcast is brought to you in partnership with the Financial Services Compensation Scheme. Check your financial products at FSCS Protected at fscs.org.uk/thisismoney.